Okay, folks, our last presentation of the day is GE, and more specifically GE Aviation with David Joyce, who's President and CEO of GE Aviation. So we're thrilled to have GE to anchor the event. Trevor Schallenberg, who heads up the investor relations effort, is here also, and I think many of you know, or hopefully you all know, Carter Copeland, who is now the aerospace analyst at Barclays, who's going to help also in the Q&A. This is going to be slightly different. We're going to have some slides. David wants to run through, I think, about 9 slides just to give some context of what's going on at GE Aviation in particular, and then we'll open it up to Q&A. Just as a public service announcement, we do have our analyst roundtable at 5:30. It's on the third floor. Again, refreshments will be served. And we will have a lively roundtable debate around the more interesting presentations of the day and what we learned and what we didn't learn and what we hope to learn tomorrow. So please join us for that. We also, I personally am excited about these little handheld devices you guys have been using all day. But if you're not quite as excited, or if you are, please provide the feedback, because we'd like to know whether we whether we'll be adopting this more broadly next year and open it up to all 3 tracks, not just one, and use it more aggressively. Now, you know, there's a couple kinks to work out in asking Q&A and making sure everybody knows how to use the devices, but I think we're getting there pretty quickly, and I personally have found it pretty useful. I know the corporates have enjoyed the feedback as well. Okay, well, look, with that, why don't we pass it over to David, who's going to walk through his slides, and then come back, and we'll sit down and have our usual Q&A session.
Thank you very much. Scott, Carter?
You're welcome.
I thought I would just put together a few slides to give some perspective and then allow you guys to have at it on the questions and answers. I usually do an analyst meeting around the air shows every year, and a number of you probably follow us from that, but for those of you that are not as familiar with GE Aviation, I thought it would be worthwhile at least to introduce the portfolio. We look at the portfolio really in 5 segments: the original equipment manufacturing of the commercial engines, which is about $4.9 billion in 2011, the servicing of those engines in the commercial world, which is a little bit north of $7 billion, as you can see on the chart. Then we combine both military engines and services together as one segment of the military because of the uniqueness of those customers, and that's about $3.7 billion of the portfolio. Systems, which represents the Smiths business that GE Aviation purchased now 5 years ago. And then finally, business and general aviation, where we try to go to market as a single organization in business and general aviation through all the products. That would be the systems as well as the engine products. So that's for Gulfstream and for Bombardier and for Embraer and the Phenom and Cessna, the Honda Jet would all come underneath that business and general aviation portfolio. This is really a very, very solid GE business, as evidenced by its performance over the last decade. Revenue growth CAGR of about 7% in a relatively volatile environment, as you all know. And at the same time, we've done a good job of growing our existing leadership in the installed base. We are the largest manufacturer of jet engines in commercial, and I'll show you some of those statistics in a minute. And at the same time, we've done a really good job of investing in the next generation. This business really is a model that's all about putting the right products on the right airplanes and platforms, and then creating, if you will, the opportunity to service those engines over time as your installed base continues to grow. We went into the decade just underneath 2,200 engines in production a year, and we leave this decade just underneath 3,000. At the same time, as you can see, oil went up 5x. So it's very nice performance, and I'll show you how we're positioned for the next decade. So as I look at the commercial environment right now, this is kind of how we see it. We see passenger demand in 2012 up again for the third year, somewhere north of 4%, which is a good thing. We see freight finally snapping back. Freight had a tough year, especially the second half of 2011. We see freight traffic on the rebound. We see oil, although today 105.88 as a WTI is much higher than we think the average is going to be for the year, ex any exogenous shock that may occur. We see oil to be pretty stable, and we see the crack spread, which is the spread that the airlines pay for the high octane that they burn, to stay pretty stable as well. And within that environment, we will increase our deliveries of commercial engines by 14% 2012 over 11, and the shop visits on the fleets we see in service will go up by about 4%. At the same time, not only is this 2012 important to us, what is really important is the bottom right-hand side of this chart, which is where the ramp rates on the airplanes are going in the next 3 years. And you can see whether it be the Boeing 737s or the Airbus A320s or the 777s or the 787s, every single one of these airplanes is increasing and ramping in its production, which of course flows down to us times two and in some cases times four in terms of our ramp rates on the engines. So we are very active right now inside our supply chain, making sure that we have clarity on the ramp rates that we need to have, the plant and equipment that we need to have, the various sites that we need to make sure we're in order to ensure that we can hit the deliveries of this business over the next 4 years. So for perspective, 2012 will be somewhere around 3,400, another 400 engines over 2011, and we'll see that go again by 400 by 2013. To give you some idea, those production numbers are terrific because, of course, they lend themselves to a lot of productivity. So in addition to the work we're doing on variable cost productivity, we can take advantage of the volume in terms of productivity. So, you know, targeting 50 basis points of margin expansion is something that we feel very comfortable with in 2012. So if you take a look at the in-service fleet at our customers and project it out to 2015, we think the total fleet of flying airplanes will be somewhere around 24,500. Of those, GE will power 22%, and our CFM joint venture with the French, with Safran Snecma, will power another 42%. And our custom service agreement backlog, our CSA backlog, will be somewhere up around $76 billion by 2015. The right-hand side translates that in-service fleet to departures. And if you look at that chart, it says that by 2015 on a forecast, there'll be about 24 million departures, about 68% of the world's departures, that'll be powered by CFM, GE, and the Engine Alliance. And it's those departures then that are a proxy, if you will, for the services franchise in this business. You know, every takeoff and every landing is a cycle, and every cycle puts work on the engine, which then requires an overhaul. So that position, 68% of those departures by 2015, leads us, as a result of this great positioning of today's installed base, to make the investments we need to in the future, which we're right involved with as we speak, in all segments, whether it be business and general aviation with Bombardier product, the Honda Jet, or the turboprops that we're working on in Czech, or whether it be the narrow bodies with the 737 MAX, the Airbus Neo, or the COMAC C919, or the wide bodies with the 747-8, which is in service as a cargo variant with five customers right now, and the 787, which we hope to be into service with JAL as our first customer sometime this quarter, if we're on track. As we look forward on those six engines, Passport for the new Global 7000, 8000, which, you know, will be at least 8% better in fuel burn than anything else of that size when it goes into service, the GE Honda engine powering the Honda Jet, which will go into service in 2013, the CFM LEAP, which is the next generation in the CFM family, a 40-year history of narrow-body excellence, the GNX we just talked about, the H80, which is our little turboprop out of Czech, and then the GE9X, which is the next generation of the GE90, the big engine on the 777, which we already are working on some of the technology we need to be ready for that by the end of the decade. That all results itself in an annual R&D and launch expense of somewhere between 1.3 and 1.5 going forward from 2011 and 12 and probably through 13 and 14. However, it generates a future potential of close to $250 billion in services revenue. So this really does represent how we think about this business. It's for us, it's a virtuous cycle. It's that installed base that throws off this services opportunity, which then allows us to reinvest in order to ensure we're on the right platforms for the next generation. And it's the growth in that production that allows us to drive the productivity we need to in production at the same time to make sure that we're improving and growing our margins from a contribution margin. In addition, I might add, to price, which as these engines get out in the field like the GNX and they demonstrate themselves and the fuel burn advantage, it allows us to reprice the portion of the unsold order book. So that's kind of how the model works. Switching to the military position, right now, if you look at the global installed fleet of military engines, we represent 22,000 of those engines. If you look at the Department of Defense, which is just U.S., it's on the right-hand side. That's our penetration in the critical market segments from rotorcraft to combat all the way down to marine. You know, the military is in a much different position than we're seeing in commercial. The story there is really about three strategies, all wrapped around acquisition reform. The first one being that we deliver on the advanced technologies, knowing that we're going to have to do some cost share. So if you will, the next generation of engines that is being protected through the science and technology budgets by the DOD, we're very active in that. And quite frankly, the work we're doing in the commercial programs is going to be a very nice leverage point on ensuring that we not only meet but can actually beat the competition on advancing the state of technology on the next generation of these airplanes. We're also focused with that installed base on upgrades, both in terms of life extension upgrades as well as performance extension upgrades. And we have active upgrade programs in each one of these segments on the airplanes that we power. You know, as the military is really going to be more dependent on these legacy systems because of the reduction in budget, we have an opportunity for much less money to upgrade performance or extend life, which is a real win-win for both the military and us. And finally, we're targeting international growth opportunities, both in terms of international platforms, like the light combat aircraft in India we won, or the Gripen airplane, which we won, as well as targeting international growth opportunities with U.S. fighters, like the F-15 contract that we just won in Saudi Arabia, or in Oman, or in Qatar, all of which are active campaigns that we're working on as we speak. So I like our position in the military, and I think we've got the right focus to be on the right side of a shrinking budget relative to acquisition reform. What really bounds this whole thing together for us is an absolute belief that it's technology leadership that allows you to really put these products out generation after generation. And we integrate our technology leadership through the global research centers, and it is a big advantage for us. All five of these centers are active and do work for all of the GE industrial businesses. So if you think about whether it be an aerothermal solution for aviation or energy, whether it be a material solution that we may use in locomotives or in aviation or in energy, or it's a diagnostic solution that finds its way starting in healthcare in a carbon-based system but finds its way into one of the engines at some point in time, or whether it be a prognostic analytic software solution in our software center of excellence that we're putting out in San Francisco. We spend a lot of time with the folks that run the global research labs to make sure the integration of all of our technology needs are met by 3,000 great research employees, and we put a lot of money up at the research labs on a yearly basis throughout all of the industrial businesses. So with all that in mind, this is what the financial profile for the business looks like. We closed 2011 at about a $3.5 billion operating profit. We see good growth on that this year. We see double-digit growth on our services. Europe is the one portion of the world that we're monitoring, as you can imagine. We see our engine deliveries, as I said, up north of 10%. We do see margin expansion at least at 50 basis points, driven by both the growth in volume as well as our variable cost productivity efforts. And the commercial activity globally remains very strong if you take a look at our backlog. Our backlog on commercial engines is about 8,000, so which is really long. So we see a lot of good commercial growth. We see financing available to buy airplanes, which means that that our customers are going to continue to shop. So in summary, before I sit down, a great business that really does understand the concept of investing and delivering. Very critical that we pick the right products and that we pick the right airplanes. We do have a very, very good installed base, and it's growing, which allows us to continue the investment in the portfolio in the future and make sure that the underpinning value that we never lose track of is technical leadership as the basis for our value proposition. And with that, I'll sit down and we can start questions, okay?
Perfect.
Great.
Thank you, David.
Yep.
While you make your way over, I'll ask the first couple questions. Carter's going to chime in, and then we'll open it up to the audience as well. One of the things that has changed a couple times over the 10 years or so that I've covered your stock is that GECAS was part of GE Capital, and then it was moved into into the aviation business, and now it's been moved back into capital again. How has that changed? I mean, talk about your relationship with GECAS at the aircraft leasing business, for those of you who don't know, which I think has been a very important business in many ways. But now that it's not underneath your day-to-day...
It really was never underneath mine. It was, you know, when we had the vice chairman's role,
yep,
which was the level right above me, GECAS was part of that vice chairman's responsibility.
Okay.
So we still were totally independent. And I'll tell you, there's been no change in the way that the underpinning risk analysis is done in capital, whether it was inside the family or not.
Right.
All those deals still went through the capital board, regardless of where the organizational structure told them they reported. You know, the metrics in the capital board have not changed in 10 years. And so the relationship is very strong, and it has been with Norm. The thing that I like about working with GECAS more than anything is just how quickly we can triangulate on market trends. You know, as a leaser, they have a really great indication of what's going on in the market. So we spend a lot of time together, whether it be during the growth playbook period or any time, just making sure that we're triangulating on what we're seeing around the world. Those conversations occur weekly between the vice presidents and GECAS. But I would say in terms of the working relationship to get deals done, it's no different than it has been for the last 10 years. Both very bullish on the industry, and it's working the same.
Okay. Next question for me is just, you have this fairly aggressive joint venture in China and have done very well from a share perspective, at least according to folks we've talked to. But some of your competitors have complained that you've been extra aggressive or taking risk. You've had a lot of experience from a corporate perspective, whether it be power generation or otherwise, you've had a lot of experience dealing with the Chinese over time. What's your comfort level that you're going down the right path there, that technology share is acceptable and worth the risk, and that you're positioned appropriately?
Sure. Well, let's put it in perspective. You know, we bought Smith's, and the avionics piece of Smith's was probably fourth in a horse race of four players.
Yep.
Right? And so you ask yourself, when you're that size, how you're going to move, you know, where you're going to grow. We knew the C919 was the next platform that we had an opportunity to demonstrate ourselves on, and we knew that we couldn't get on it if we didn't have some form of a joint venture. And we're not the only one with a joint venture. Every single Western supplier who's supplying to the 919, except the engines, I might add,
right,
which are already a joint venture between us and Safran, are joint ventured with the Chinese in some way, shape, or form. The difference between what we did and what the other folks did is they did a manufacturing joint venture solely dedicated to the 919 platform.
Okay.
Because of our positioning in the marketplace, we said, look, if we're going to do this joint venture, let's do a joint venture with AVIC that can create a global company that can compete outside of China.
Right.
And that's probably the single biggest difference, is that we literally are trying to create the next generation CFM in the avionics business that will compete as an entity on other platforms outside of China when it's all said and done. So hopefully all of the lessons we learn in China are going to be leveraged to a company that can compete outside. And you know, I'm very satisfied with the position we're in there. I don't, and you know, they have their process. We have to register the joint venture. It has to be legally recognized. We had to go through an antitrust approval in Germany, which we just finished. So we're marching right down the road to get this thing done. And at the same time, we have a large collaboration of engineers to make sure we keep on track for the airplane. And at the end of the day, we will create the avionics suite for that airplane. It'll be the demonstration that the joint venture can execute. And hopefully it'll be the branding calling card we can take elsewhere to get more business. And so if you ask me, am I satisfied with it? I really am, yeah. And the behaviors have been good.
What's the first chance you think you get to actually take that to the next
take it next
and a platform to
good question.
I don't see a lot of
well, you know,
platforms out there until
no, you know, now that the re-engineering decision on the 320neo and the 737 are done, you're right, it takes both of those off the hook. But there'll be platforms, there'll be business and general aviation opportunities for us, you know what I mean, which is a big play for us. And there'll be other opportunities for that'll come up. I can't tell you off the top of my head. It might be the next generation 787 if we can, or 777 if we can prove that we're ready for something of that size. We'll see. Could be a regional jet. Could be a business and general aviation opportunity. But the most important thing is that we go hunting. You know what I mean? And see what's out there. Prove that we can demonstrate to the world that we can do this, and then go out and go hunting afterwards. Okay.
Let's start to queue up the audience, and I guess Carter, if you can ask the next question, and then
I'll go ahead and ask.
And then we'll open it up.
I wondered if you might speak to the aftermarket a little bit, the services business. You've got in your chart shop visits up 4% for the year, which is less than traffic. Which you said, you know, thinking somewhere north of 4. When you look at your fleet of engines and all the engines we delivered in the kind of last up cycle, you're really getting to the sweet spot of the kind of echo boom of last cycle. I'd assume you'd have more shop, a bigger increase in shop visits. Mm-hmm. And what I'm kind of wondering is there something, are the engines staying on wing longer? Is the services outlook more muted than you expected because of some trend like that? I would have assumed you'd had
more. No, we have a lag. Think about what we see in the shop, depending on the engine, right? The high cycle engines, like the narrow bodies, we normally see them hit the shop 4 to 6 years after they go in service, somewhere in that. Wide bodies, 2 to 3 years. So, for example, after JAL takes its GNXs in March, right, 2 to 3 years, we're going to start seeing the shop visits occur on those. And we are starting, the mix on shop visits is very favorable. We're starting to see a lot of GE90s come in. Those are very big engines, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And they take, so that's a very favorable mix. We're starting to see some of the regional jets kind of not grow as fast as we thought they would. That's okay. The CF6 is starting, you know, to flatten, but it still has some positive growth. And the narrow bodies are doing great from the Dash 7s and the CFM56-5Bs, as you said. So, you know, we're pretty comfortable with 4%. I would say that this year we're positively, so far, you know, it's February, so it's very early. I would say America is more positive than we thought it would be, as is China. And Europe is, of course, less because of the softness. Europe's softness is not completely healed by the upswing we're seeing in the U.S. and China, but it still is a nice offsetting gain, if you will, in what we had thought the demand would be in the first 2 months of the year. So, you know, we're all watching Europe, especially wide bodies in Europe. You know, it's the Lufthansa's, the KLM Air France's, the BA's, the big wide body guys that we're watching closely to see what they're doing. And a lot of that just deals with conserving cash at this point, so shop visits won't occur. They'll hold off on the shop visits, but they'll come when they come. You can hold off for some period of time.
Maintenance is.
No, you can, honestly. You can, you know, if you have spares, you know, you can drop an engine, put a spare on wing, and just hold it. You know what I mean? And so they will defer into if they want to, but then there'll be a slug, you know, that comes flying into the system.
Inevitably,
and the reality is, we have to make sure we're ready for the slug, right? Because we can fill up every shop. We can fill up every blade manufacturing facility we have on three shifts if these things come in a big slug all at once and need to be done. So staying very close with our customers and making sure that we can help them through managing this thing is an important perspective for us.
Let's open up the audience. We've been... We get a little shy at the end of the
tired everybody.
Afternoon. Peter, if you hold it in and talk about 6 inches from you, there you go.
Okay. What data do you have from maybe the fleet of planes that would have been the mid to late 90s that the model of kind of, I don't want to say discounting, but pricing the OEM sale on an engine at a low margin with the service tail that you expect to last, you know, 20 plus years, has held up and you've earned the returns. In that same time period, you've had oil prices go up fivefold, and there's a clear emphasis by fleets to underutilize the older, less fuel-efficient planes, which may hurt the service cycles of the planes that are 15 plus years old. And so as you wrap all that and see it through almost the whole life cycle, because it's almost been 20 years for some of the stuff from the mid-'90s. You know, does the IRR model, you know, kind of hold?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, we do a lot of these end up on long-term contracts, which is one way you protect yourself about changes in what the customer does on frequency of utilization. If they don't fly them as much, then they don't come in for overhaul. Overhaul is where we spend the money. They pay us on a dollar-per-hour basis to fly it. And then depending on how long it's in, then we actually incur costs when we overhaul the engine. So I would say the model holds. The long-term service agreements have actually helped with the model in terms of stabilizing it in a lot of ways. And, you know, if you're a narrow-body operator, let's say a 737 or an A320 guy, just to give you some perspective, right, those things take off and land 7 to 9 times a day. They burn about $3.8 million of fuel, carry about 430,000 folks a year. Network stability is job one, right? Reliability, if you really look at it, if they have 20 minutes at the gate, if they're a low-cost carrier, that's the turn time on those airplanes. So the dialogue around the value is no disruption of service, zero disruption of service. Fuel is one piece of the variable cost. Disruption of service is a huge piece of the variable cost if anything would go wrong with those engines. And so our solutions, both in the '90s as well as LEAP, are really balanced to make sure we have clear recognition of what that market need is and that we can assure that folks like Southwest or JetBlue or Ryanair or AirAsia all have the right reliability so that we don't interrupt their networks at any time, you know. And in some cases, a little bit more fuel burn without a disruption is guaranteed dispatch reliability and capability. It's the trade works with some of the older equipment as long as it's reliable for them and they need it, you know, and they can get demand.
Next question.
Tony, oops.
Tony.
Do you have a working prototype of the LeapX? And have you done other engines, maybe on the military side, that are similar to the LeapX so that the execution of this can go off without a hitch?
Yeah. LeapX, first of all, you know, the way that the development program starts is you run the cores, which is the compression system, the combustion system, and the high-pressure turbine, otherwise known as the core of the engine, the heart of the engine. We're on our second iteration of the core design for LEAP as we speak. The second iteration of the core is running as we speak. And the genesis of LEAP is not from the military, but it really represents a genesis of a program that's more than 15 years old, starting with, on our side, the GE90, leading to the GEnx. And if you think about the GEnx now being scaled and the next advancement in technology being put into the GEnx, that gives you the core for the LEAP. And similarly, on SNECMA's side, SNECMA Safran, our partner, they have been working on technology advancement for the fan and the booster and the low-pressure turbine at the same time that we have. So, you know, our advanced technology programs to get ready for this moment, knowing full well that we would have to replace the CFM architecture someday, have been in the making for 15 years. And I would say that what we're doing right now on GEnx in terms of its flights on the 747 in service and getting ready on the 78 gives us a great deal of confidence that we can execute on LEAP confidently. So for us, the challenge is taking LEAP, taking the GEnx architecture, bringing it down into a single-aisle network that flies a lot more cycles a day and making it reliable for the customer with the same fuel burn benefit. And that really is the design challenge for the engineering team.
Right there.
Hi, David. I had a question. We're a few years into this commercial aerospace upcycle, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on the sort of duration you expect over the cycle. And I mean, part of the reason I'm asking is, you know, you put up a chart, you have traffic growing in the 4%-6% range, which is, you know, typically we see a double-digit year, which we haven't seen as yet.
Yeah.
But if you look at the delivery rates or the production rates, in many ways they are even greater than that. So I just wanted, conversely, of course, we do have a bigger backlog. So I just want to know if you see anything different this cycle, and I just wanted to get your thoughts around that.
I think all of us feel that this cycle, you know, if I would have honestly thought that this first quarter would have actually been recovered faster than it did. Europe really did put a little damper on the recovery. The demand for air travel is there. I mean, it really is. The recovery, I think, is absolutely being overshadowed by what's happening in Europe right now, in my opinion. But if you look at China and the revenue passenger demand in China, India, Asia Pacific region, Brazil, you know, a lot of the emerging markets, there is just an absolute need for essential air travel, and they need equipment. They really do need equipment. So you're not going to see the equipment going in at unless it's replacement in Europe and in the U.S., right? The U.S. buys are, in many cases, replacement buys at Southwest, at American. Those are replacement buys for MD-80s, for 737 Classics. You know, that's what you're seeing. But for growth, you're going to see just a big need in Asia, particularly where the big growth markets are. Will we get to double-digit demand growth on a worldwide basis? You know, I don't know. I think we're there almost already in some regions of the world, Asia, and as it grows out, I think its growth is going to maintain a very strong growth path for the next, you know, 5-8 years. Will we see double-digit growth in demand in the United States and in Europe? It's hard for me to forecast something like that over the next 3 to 5 years, to be very honest with you. So in aggregate, I don't know if we're ever going to get much, you know, above good single-digit growth, which will still be on a global sense, you know, a good growth path for us. But you'll see a lot of new equipment go in for two very different reasons, the need for more growth in emerging markets and the need for replacement cycles because of the price of fuel in today's developed markets. Both will drive a cycle within the airplane companies that causes these ramps in their production cycle.
Just to follow up on that, on speaking to those ramps, so if we've got, you know, 30-40% of this, you know, delivery profile at a Boeing and Airbus is a replacement profile, you got 60% of growth coming from the markets you talk about. We've got a lot of carriers that have, you know, 50 airplane fleets with 250 planes on order.
Yeah.
We're ramping up to meet that demand, and as you look at some of those pockets of growth, take wide bodies in the Middle East as a, you know, example.
It's always a classic, right?
How do you think about the risk that we might actually overproduce? You know, we could make the case maybe we've overordered in some of those regions. Obviously, we haven't ramped up production, so we're not over delivering yet. But when we get out there and we're delivering all of these engines to some of these regions, are we susceptible to a greater cyclical downturn than we've seen in the past?
Yeah, I think it's a valid point. I'll tell you, this is going to be a long answer, so bear with me. If you aggregate the world demand, right, versus these ramp rates, you'll find that we are still under capacity on an aggregate basis. Does that mean it's matched in every region? Absolutely not, right? But on an aggregate basis, you'll see that even these ramp rates, if you look at how many revenue passenger seats we're adding, will be underneath from a capacity perspective where demand will be. I think your question's valid. Are we going to end up with some region that is over-ordered to the point where the economics of putting more airplanes in just doesn't work? Hopefully, that will result in such a bad economic trade when load factors fall off, right, that it will create a redistribution of those assets somewhere else in the world, right?
Yeah.
You know, the United States is a great example. We are growing demand in the U.S. by somewhere between 1.5% and 2%, and yet capacity is being held to less than 7/10. So this group of airlines here in the U.S., guys like Tom Horton and Gary and Jeff Smyzik, these folks get it. You know what I mean? That you've got to find a way to create more demand than you have supply so that you have some pricing power in this marketplace or else. And load factors are up north of 80%, as most of you are frustrated with as you fly around the United States. But that's not by accident. You know, that is really not by accident. So I would say that you're going to see some redistribution of order books. You always do. But I think in general that they've been, you know, they're pretty matched. They're actually undermatched, demand versus supply. Going out probably for the next 5 years. Our own analysis. That being said, Emirates will take their 100th 777-300ER next Friday, right? Just to give you a perspective of just how incredible the world is.
And they've got 98 380s on order.
Yeah, but they will literally take, I mean, they'll be flying 100 777-300ERs. Yeah.
Next question.
Why don't we talk briefly about, now that we've pushed the LeapX, you know, now we've pushed the 737, A320, that market decision out a good 10 years, which is, with the continuation of LeapX, a great deal for you. As you think about engine development, which now this is going to, you know, go over the next 5 to 10 years, and think about how the LeapX will be positioned against the geared turbofan,
sure,
which is going to have more time to have another iteration. And I guess there's some view in the marketplace that that's a sort of architectural change that can then further be optimized, whereas the LeapX is a, you know, already an optimization of existing technology. Is that right? Is that wrong? How do you think about technology development game over the next 10 years now that we have more time to fight it?
Yeah. I think that here's kind of how I look at it. There's no engine company that has invested over the last 15 years in its research and development as much as we have. And so the advancements in fundamental technology inside one of these engines that we have been able to demonstrate with GE90, the 115, with GENX, is truly decades above the other guys. As a result of that, we have a lot of confidence that while people would say LEAP is the last in the generation of optimizations, our multi-generational product plan on LEAP probably has two more swings at the plate in it, at least, that we can see right now based on materials that are in development and in technology. In fact, we're actually building out our footprint in manufacturing to be ready to implement those before the end of the decade. So from our perspective, you know, there's two ways that you can create efficiency. One is you do something, and both are valid, by the way. You do something with the architecture of the engine that you have to in order to get the efficiencies, or you keep the architecture that you have and you do something within the engine itself with materials and with aerodynamics to keep the efficiencies growing. So let me give you a perspective. The CF6-80, which was the 767 engine, right? It was the most advanced engine of its time. You know, I'll show you my age now. So back in the 80s, when that thing went into production, everyone said, that's it. Nobody could ever make a turbofan any better than this one. This is the entitlement by physics. This is what God said a turbofan should look like, right? So the GENX will go into service this year with somewhere close to 19% better fuel burn on the same architectural design, okay? And so I think that's the perspective that I'd leave you with when it comes to this discussion. Both solutions are going to compete in the marketplace, and our message is, let's get on with it. Game on. You know what I mean? Let's go get them in service, and let's see who's got what it takes in this marketplace. And if we learn something from Pratt, great. If they learn something from us, terrific. Right? But let's get on with it and see who's got what, you know?
Fantastic.
You know?
Game on, I like it. Well, that opens up a good question for you, Trevor, which is, given the vastness of the GE portfolio, do you still have the confidence that 2012 is a year where you can see get back to double-digit industrial growth again, and led by businesses like aviation and, you know, power generation should get a little bit better, right? And there's some signs there that that people are turning on gas units again, given where prices are. I mean, where is your confidence in, from where you sit now versus a couple weeks ago when you, a few weeks ago, reported earnings? Confidence was high, but
sure,
has that changed?
Thanks for the last question, Scott. So there's four kind of things that are important, I think, to most investors that we talk to is, one, having double-digit earnings growth on both industrial and capital. You know, capital is going to come a lot from the real estate improving, so that's fairly locked and loaded. The industrial side, we still feel good about. The second is the organic growth of 5 to 10%, and with the backlogs you've seen, that's fairly locked in at David's business, at transportation, and, you know, the oil and gas and energy business. The margin expansion is obviously another big item. You know, 50 basis points is what we're shooting for this year, and you know, hopefully you see some businesses in the first quarter that start to demonstrate improvement there. Some of the takeout this year will be on SG&A internationally in markets that aren't growing as fast. You know, we layered on John Rice's organization. We had some duplication, so you'll get that from that session. And then restarting the GE Capital dividend, and we feel good still, no change in communications on that. So those are four big items for us and for investors, and it's, a lot of that's execution, not market risk.
Yeah. And the execution risk, you know, we're in the middle of February. I mean, what, you know, at what point do we have visibility where, I mean, is it literally a quarter by quarter thing, or do you start to realize, particularly, let's just take David's business, for example, you start to realize February, March, hey, I do have my cost structure in place for what I see in front of me. I do have the shop visits. I do have everything that's going to, you know, the mix is going to be there. I mean, when do we have a better sense of that? And that,
sure, for the total company or for David's business?
I'd say total company, but I think David's business is a good example to use, too.
Do you want to talk about a little bit how your margins develop over the year, David?
Yeah, I would say that we've got a pretty good line of sight to where we think things are going to lay out this year. Certainly on the production side, that's not the issue. Utilization, we track utilization. We are in direct contact with most of our customers. So, you know, we feel like we've got a pretty good path to the year. And, you know, our business is a business that really is kind of, you look out 3 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not, you know, when we go and talk with Jeff, we never get away with just talking about the year. It's
sure.
The year plus two, even at an S2 for us.
Yeah.
And so I feel we've got a pretty good line of sight all the way to the end of the year. You know, we're watching, just like everyone else is, and some form of exogenous shock on oil, right, which would we'd all have to regroup if that occurred. And we're watching to make sure that Europe goes the way that it looks like it's going, and we'll start to see some more, if you will, relaxation of cash policies in the airlines, which will loosen up some of this equipment for overhaul. That'd be our two watch items.
Okay. And
so for total company, you know, we did some restructuring at year end, so we would like to show some margin improvement in a couple businesses starting early in the year. That'll build in some other businesses as you execute that funnel of projects that Jeff talked about in December. But the goal is by year end to have that 50 basis points. But you should show some early improvement by a couple businesses starting soon.
Okay, great. Well, thank you all for your questions and patience. Again, 5:30 on the third floor, excuse me. Thank you, David and Trevor,
sure,
for participating. And
thanks for having me.
Thanks, Scott.
See you all later.
Yep.
Thanks,
Carter. Thank you all.